A look at compounders through the lens of the intelligent investor, published on Thursday, the 28th of January, 2021. As you may have noticed, I have not always been entirely complimentary about the style of value investing espoused by disciples of Benjamin Graham. I have been a frequent critic of the low price to book approach to valuation that Graham popularized, and in my most recent investor letter, I took a critical look at the concept of margin of safety, whereby my critique was more around the way it is implemented rather than the concept per se. Believe it or not, I still harbor the ambition, when the time comes, of being admitted to value investor heaven. I imagine myself in front of the pearly gates in a queue of investors. Benjamin Graham and Warren Buffett, should I outlive him, a guy's got a dream, stand before the gates, inviting the worthy to pass and directing the others to hell. I'm not quite sure what investing hell looks like, but I imagine there being a lot of momentum traders and chart technicians there. The main capital allocation choice is between a Swiss government bond and the Trump Organization. In an effort to rehabilitate myself, I thought I would discuss the current popularity of compounders by using that Bible of the compounder aficionados, the intelligent investor. Admittedly, that last sentence was somewhat facetious. What follows, though, is intended sincerely. In my view, the intelligent investor offers a useful framework to make sense of the compounder phenomenon. Before getting to why, it is perhaps worth laying the groundwork for the discussion, but by defining what compounders are and what the phenomenon is. So what is a compounder? I expect everyone has a slightly different understanding of what the term compounder means. But generally, it describes a company that can grow or compound earnings by reinvesting capital, not by raising external capital. Compounders are likely to share some or all of the following characteristics. 1. High returns on capital. 2. Profitable on an underlying, not necessarily reported basis. 3. Large total addressable markets, or TAMs. 4. A growing competitive advantage. 5. A strong culture characterized by humility and adaptability, essential to overcome growth pains. 6. A founder who likely embodies these values. And 7. Predictable, better still, recurring revenues. This is not a definitive list, and different companies will have these qualities in different quantities, but it gives a sense of what I'm driving towards. Google most certainly is a compounder. Deutsche Bank probably is not. So why do compounders matter? Betting on compounders has been a winning strategy, to say the least, over the last decades. Finding just one compounder, and equally important, holding onto it, can be transformative to an investor's returns. Buffett credits his unparalleled track record with a handful of investment decisions, all of which, I might add, involved buying companies that went on to compound for decades. As a result, many new funds have sprung up that focus solely on compounders, and other funds have switched their focus towards compounders. I too have felt a strong gravitational pull towards compounders, though I do retain an open mind about investing in other types of businesses as well. The general shift towards compounders has led many investors, including me, to question whether it is sustainable. I find myself torn between two apparently competing ideas. On the one hand, there is a certain inevitability of the returns of a compounding business, properly identified. Even if you had bought Amazon.com at the height of the insanity of the dot-com bubble, you would have done spectacularly well if you had held it till today. There is virtually no price at which a great compounder, properly identified, cannot be bought. On the other hand, I feel a deep sense of unease when huge amounts of capital pile into a single strategy and a consensus develops that you can't lose. The question, does it still make sense to invest in compounders, seems more pertinent today than ever. So what does Ben Graham have to say? Graham did not write to my knowledge about compounders, but he did write about what he termed growth stocks. He defined growth stocks as follows, quote, "A growth stock may be defined as one that has done this in the past and is expected to do so in the future," end quote. This description falls somewhat short of my definition of a compounder above. However, many of today's compounders have certainly done well recently and look set to continue to do so in the future. I feel fairly sure that Graham would identify today's compounders as growth companies. For the remainder of this memo, I will use the terms compounders and growth companies interchangeably, notwithstanding the obvious definitional differences. Graham was a well-known skeptic of growth companies. In Chapter 6 of The Intelligent Investor, first edition, Graham asks rhetorically, why not simply buy the most promising looking growth companies and let the cash roll in? Consider his response. Quote, there are two catches to this simple idea. The first is that common stocks with good records and apparently good prospects sell at correspondingly high prices. The investor may be right in his judgment of their prospects and still not fare particularly well, merely because he has paid in full, and perhaps overpaid, for the expected prosperity. The second is that his judgment as to the future may prove wrong. Unusually rapid growth cannot keep up forever when a company has already registered a brilliant expansion. Its very increase in size makes a repetition of its achievement more difficult. At some point, the growth curve flattens out and in many cases turns downwards. End quote. Graham's skepticism is rooted in three main objections. First, few companies can sustain their growth, i.e. genuine growth companies are rare. Second, the analyst's judgment about a company's long-term prospects is often flawed, i.e. there are lots of false positives. Third, growth companies have high valuations, i.e. the positive long-term prospects are already priced in. The conclusion that generations of value investors have drawn is that investing in growth companies is a mug's game to be avoided at all costs. This is without question Graham's opinion too. However, what people miss is that his skepticism was clearly rooted in the context in which he was investing. Based on the opportunity set he saw and extensively documented in The Intelligent Investor, he thought the odds of successfully investing in growth companies was poor. This being the case, is it any wonder he was skeptical about doing so? In my view, the lesson to be derived from The Intelligent Investor is not that investing in growth does not work, but that every generation of investors needs to figure out for itself what the odds of it working are. Graham's approach offers an excellent framework to figure out just what those odds are. In essence, Graham poses three questions. 1. How prevalent are growing companies? 2. How predictable is the continuation of their growth? And 3. How much of the growth is already reflected in the share price? Let's go through each one in turn. Question 1. Are growth companies prevalent? This question is important, as if growth companies were not prevalent, the risk of identifying false positives would be high, even for the most talented analyst. This is known as the base rate fallacy. Imagine a particularly talented analyst is correct in her analysis 90% of the time, but only 1 in 10 of the companies she analyzes is a bona fide compounder. The maths dictates she will correctly identify a compounder only 50% of the time, no better than a coin toss. In my view, growth companies are far more prevalent today than one would intuitively think. Given the low economic growth since the great financial crisis, one would not typically expect to find too many growing companies. Underneath the surface, though, there has been a tremendous amount of economic upheaval, with entire industries being disrupted by new innovative companies. If you recognize the momentousness of these changes taking place and continuing to take place, it is not an exaggeration to say that growth is everywhere. This does not solve the problem of who the winners are, but it is fair to say that there's going to be a high number of winners. The base rate is firmly in the growth investor's favor, at least compared to the situation in Graham's day. Question 2. Is growth predictable? Growth seems to be far more predictable today than it was in Graham's day. Companies with recurring revenue models are far more prevalent. Furthermore, many of today's leading economic sectors seem to be characterized by winner-takes-all or winner-takes-most dynamic. The companies with a dominant position today seem destined to be still further entrenched in the future, thanks to network effects and economies of scale. Question three, is growth priced in? Over the last decade, it clearly was not. For example, in the tech space, investors repeatedly made the mistake of assuming that the size of the market opportunity for the growing companies was capped by the size of the market they were disrupting. Many examples spring to mind where this was the case. For example, Google and Facebook's market opportunity was thought to be capped by the size of the advertising market, the largest part of which historically was TV advertising, in which only the largest 100 or so companies in any country could participate. Facebook today has over 10 million advertisers. From today's perspective, the situation may well have flipped. The size of a company's TAM is the single most frequent topic I hear discussed in investor meetings. Investors clearly have it firmly on their radar screens. Furthermore, the stock market seems quick to price companies with large TAMs as if much of that TAM has already been realized. On the other hand, I continue to be surprised by the opportunities that the best companies can create out of their core competencies, effectively creating new TAMs that investors, including myself, were either unaware of or simply dismissed. The question of valuation is the one I feel most unsure about. So what do these answers tell us? At least two of Graham's questions can be answered with a resounding yes. Yes, there are a higher number of growing or compounding businesses today. Yes, that growth seems to be more predictable, inevitable even, today than it was in Graham's day. I realize that the more interesting question for most people is whether the growth is priced in. However, it is worth pausing and reflecting on what the affirmative responses to the first two questions mean. They imply that it was perfectly rational that the compounder strategy has attracted more capital and more adherence. The shift towards compounders is almost certainly structural rather than cyclical, at least until the economy goes through the next epochal change. When this happens, it will no doubt catch a new generation of investors off guard as they fail to appreciate how the change in the economy subtly shifts the odds of correctly identifying a growth company. For now, though, I firmly expect a disproportionate amount of the world's capital to continue to be directed towards would-be compounders. This leaves us with the third question of whether all this is priced in. It is impossible to answer this question without a deep understanding of a large enough sample of the world's businesses as to be statistically relevant. A deep understanding is indispensable. Easy to calculate multiples such as EV to revenue or price to earnings, favored by many market prognosticators as a substitute for thoughtful analysis, reveal virtually nothing about a company's underlying unit economics, growth opportunity, and hence valuation. Unfortunately, I do not have this depth of knowledge on a sufficiently large number of companies to be able to make a sweeping statement on the market valuation today. However, I do think that the answers to the first two questions provide a clue to the answer to the third. If an opportunity is large enough and obvious enough, you would expect capital to flood into it. And this is precisely what has happened. To the extent investing in compounders was an easy route to riches, it is unlikely to remain the case for long and may indeed already no longer be the case. For sure, bona fide compounders are likely to almost always be great investments. However, the increase in prices will lower their upside, whilst at the same time increasing losses from the inevitable false positives. The overall impact will be average returns for most investors. There is never a free lunch. So what is the rational response? Some investors may read the previous paragraph and conclude that it makes sense to switch their focus away from compounders. I am not sure this is the correct lesson to draw. A corollary of there being more growing companies is that there are also more declining companies. This has to be the case for GDP growth to net out to basically zero. As such, mature businesses may be declining more frequently, with greater predictability than was the case in Graham's day. Ironically, they may be subject to the same kind of negative base rate effect that turned Graham off of growth companies in his era. Contrarians, beware. The correct response is, in my view, indicated by Graham in The Purchase of Bargain Issues, the section of The Intelligent Investor that directly follows his discussion on growth stocks. Graham writes, quote, "Thus, we have two major sources of undervaluation, A, currently disappointing results, and B, protracted neglect or unpopularity." End quote. Admittedly, he was most likely not thinking of growth companies when he wrote this, but it makes the statement no less relevant. In effect, Graham points to two sources of undervaluation, a disappointing short-term development at the company level, and neglected or unpopular areas of the market. Despite their popularity, growth companies may be a fertile breeding ground for disappointment. If a feature of a growth company is high expectations baked into its share price, it may well be more frequently subject to disappointment, the first source of undervaluation that Graham mentions. Of no less importance is the second source that Graham mentions, neglect or unpopularity. It strikes me that when many investors talk about compounders, they are thinking first and foremost about today's hottest companies, which are often found in the consumer internet and software sectors. For sure, these two sectors have had more than their fair share of compounders recently. However, there are compounders to be found in every sector. This includes unpopular and neglected sectors such as energy, financial services, and even retirement village operators. If history is anything to go by, all sectors will continue to produce compounders. All countries will too, including those which are out of favour today. In particular, I believe that pessimism in the West about the general direction of the Chinese economy and its governance is wildly misplaced. Closing thoughts. I believe Graham had a far greater appreciation of growth companies or compounders than he is widely credited with, especially when bearing in mind the fundamentally different economic context he was investing in. Consider the following statement he made in the same chapter he dedicated to skewering growth companies. Quote, "The stock of a growing company, if purchasable at a reasonable price, is obviously preferable to others." End quote. I love his use of the word obviously. The arch enemy of growth investors thought it was self-evident that the growing company is superior to all other investments, provided, of course, the investor pays a reasonable price. He does not even write a cheap price. Perhaps I'm being overly generous to myself, but I suspect that there is much I've written here that Graham would agree with. Maybe, just maybe, as I present at the pearly gates, he waves me through with the indulgent smile of a kindly father welcoming home the prodigal son. And as Buffett raises an eyebrow at his friend's quixotic judgment, Graham gives a single word response. Obviously. Thanks for listening and happy investing.